So everyone has resilience margin, and it differs from situation to situation. For example, some kids are great at jokes. They can make a joke about themselves, and they don't mind it if someone criticizes them to their face. It's no big deal. So they have a lot of margin in resilience. It's not offensive to them. But let's say someone leaves them out of a group, and that was like an important party to go to in their mind. It's a big deal. Well, their frustration tolerance lowers, and the importance of the offense rises.
Welcome to the Beautifully Complex podcast, where I share insights and strategies on parenting neurodivergent kids straight from the trenches. I'm your host, Penny Williams. I'm a parenting coach, author, and mindset mama, honored to guide you on the journey of raising your atypical kid. Let's get started. Welcome back, everybody. I am so excited today to have Brooks Gibbs here with me. And we are going to talk about emotional resilience and bullying as much as we can fit in this episode. But I want to start first, just have you introduce yourself, Brooks, for anybody who's listening. Let them know who you are and what you do.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. My name is Brooks Gibbs. I'm a resilience educator with a PhD in social psychology. And for 25 years since Columbine, where I lived after the shooting and traveled and spoke with kids from Columbine. I didn't go to that high school, but many of my friends did. And that was the birthplace of the anti-bullying movement. So it's 25 years since Columbine. And I've been speaking on this topic of aggression. I have a unique approach to it in that I don't like the word bully. I don't like the word bullying. And I'll explain why later. And I think if we want to solve this problem, we have to retire the word. That's always the first step. And then we have to look at the science of aggression. What's really going on? And then what is a simple solution so that kids don't needlessly suffer?
Well, let's jump into that. Why do we not use the word bullying, and how do we describe it instead?
Because bullying is a very difficult idea to understand. If you ask any parent or student what is bullying, they will tell you pretty much the same answer: any unwanted behavior. They might add, if they're thinkers, any unwanted behavior that I told them to stop doing, but they won't stop doing to demonstrate pervasiveness. But if you ask a teacher or a counselor or a school administrator who's been trained in the Ovais definition of bullying, along with co-author Susan Limber, it's really three things have to be involved for something to be qualified as bullying. There has to be intent to do harm. Number two, there has to be an imbalance of power, psychological power. And number three is it has to be pervasive, meaning repeated over time. Now, those definitions have morphed a little bit here and there, but they're basically the same. Those three things are always present. And so when a parent goes to a school administrator and says, my child's being bullied, well, the administrator is going to say, you know, what happened? Well, what do you mean? It doesn't matter what happened. She was called a name. She was told to stop, and she didn't stop, so she keeps calling my daughter a name. Well, I'm sorry. I know the backstory, and there wasn't intent to inflict harm on your child. They were just joking. It wasn't repeated over time. This is not an ongoing problem. This just happened once in this way. I know she did as exclusive thing. She didn't invite her to a party last week, but that's a totally different behavior. So the same behavior is not repeated over time. And, you know, sometimes your daughter is called the bully by this girl who feels like she's weaker than your daughter is. And so I really can't prove imbalance of power. And so no administrator can ever actually admit that bullying ever happened on campus, because they're stuck with the definition that's impossible to apply. And I'll give you a good example, Penny. What psychological instrument do we have to measure a child's psychological power? And then we can objectively compare the two. Oh, she clearly has less psychological power. She has more psychological power. Therefore, I know who the bully is and I know who the victim is. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
All we can do is see who's upset more. But that's not the act of science. That's an act of discernment or, you know, evaluation of a situation. What about intent? Most kids say, I'm not a bully. I don't identify as a bully. I'm a victim. She did this to me. That's why I did that to her. So there wasn't intent to do harm. There were simply retaliatory feelings that happened without even thought. Or maybe they were trying to be funny, or maybe they were being critical. So this is such a hot mess. That's why there is no, from my understanding, and I could be wrong, but I doubt it, I don't think there's a single working anti-bullying expert today. The anti-bullying movement did not survive COVID. Mm. When all the schools went back, most anti-bullying programs were canceled and they were traded in for mental health resources, social emotional learning,
right,
resilience education, because anti-bullying has failed because no one actually can define it. No one knows what's really going on. And so we're going back to some old social skills.
Yeah. And I hear you talking about looking deeper at the behavior and what's really underneath it, which we talk so much about here on the podcast and when we're working with neurodivergent kids. But I know that it is the way that we should be looking at all kids and all behavior. We tend to judge behavior from what it feels like on the surface instead of really digging deeper, as you're talking about, and figuring out what is going on underneath. Why is that behavior happening? I think, you know, to your point, if we just label someone as a bully and we ask them not to do it again, what difference might that make? Not a lot, right?
Yeah.
We have to dig deeper.
And plus, calling kids bullies is name calling. You know, we say we're against name calling and yet we label kids bullies. It's such a logical absurdity. It's such a contradiction. But you're right, Penny. The why is the bullseye to solve the social problem. And there are only four reasons why anyone is ever aggressive. I don't care if it's a squabble on a schoolyard, or if it's an international war between countries. There's only four motivations of aggression. The first motivation is someone's trying to bother you or have psychological power over you. Mm-hmm. Bother. So this is a classic sibling rivalry issue. Usually in a home, you've got one who loves to bother and another one who's easily bothered. And in there lies the toxicity. So that's one motivation. I just like bothering you. It's fun, driving you crazy, making you angry. The second motivation behind aggression is humor. Mm. Humor is extremely violent. People don't realize it. It's always at somebody's expense. Mm. Compliments are never funny. Only insults are funny. So to be funny, you have to violate a norm, which is typically insulting. And no one needs to be harmed. You know, they're supposed to laugh at a joke about themselves. Well, when they don't laugh and there is harm, it's not funny to that person, but it might be funny to the comedian who told the joke.
Right.
So the third reason why people are aggressive is, well, they're hurt by the other person. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned earlier, I did this because you said this, and you're not supposed to say that. The fourth and final reason why someone might be aggressive is because they're critical. They're wanting to help you improve, so they're pointing out a flaw and telling you about it. Well, if someone's very sensitive to criticism and they can't take a criticism, they're going to call that bullying, and they believe that's attacking them, when really, the most loving thing you can do is tell a friend what's wrong with them. Mm. That's what friends do. Faith for the wounds of a friend. It's enemies that actually say, no, keep acting stupid. Keep doing exactly what you're doing. You don't need to change anything. Now, if there's a flaw, a friend will point it out. But we translate that as bullying.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about emotional resilience, because I know you talk about that a lot in your work. And I see often in my work with neurodivergent or neurodiverse families in classrooms, that we struggle with building resilience in neurodivergent kids. And it's something that we have to really focus on and be very mindful about working on, grit and resilience both. And so I would love to talk more about how do we build that emotional resilience where I think then kids can not have a buffer, but kind of have the almost perspective to be able to look at these reasons that you've given in a more objective way almost. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. If they can think about it objectively, not subjectively, all tied in emotions, that certainly helps. That's why viewing things like games, you know, playing games is what I like to do with kids so that they could understand, you know, what's going on in a spirit of play. But to answer your question about resilience, like what is resilience? And I think the clinical terminology for resilience would be best rephrased as frustration tolerance. Mm. So someone with high frustration tolerance would be considered resilient. Someone with a low frustration tolerance would be considered not resilient. And so how do we raise the frustration tolerance, the ability to endure a harsh reality, whether that's a brightness of the light, whether that's the noise in the room, whether that's the touch of a friend who's tapping them on their shoulder, whether that's a criticism, a joke, someone trying to bother them, or, you know, someone who's upset with them. Like all these things, whether they're tactile, whether it's kinesthetic, or whether it's environmental, they can raise their frustration tolerance. And the easiest way to raise someone's frustration tolerance is to lower the importance of the offense. Lower the importance of an offense. And so that's where the real work is done. In fact, that's where most of my life's work is done, is helping people lower the importance of an offense. And so I like to use the example of an industrial elevator. Typically in a commercial building, you'll see elevators open left and right. But in an industrial kind of warehouse environment, it goes up and down, you know, and they close together and they rise together. And then you can go in and out of an elevator. Well, if you push, let's say, down on the lower part of the industrial elevator, the top, without even touching it, will automatically rise. And that's how I view resilience work, is if we can lower the importance of offense, frustration tolerance already rises. Mm-hmm. And the lower the offense is, the higher the tolerance is. And now I call that resilience margin. So everyone has resilience margin, and it differs from situation to situation. For example, some kids are great at jokes. They can make a joke about themselves, and they don't mind it if someone criticizes them to their face. It's no big deal. So they have a lot of margin in resilience. It's not offensive to them. But let's say someone leaves them out of a group, and that was like an important party to go to in their mind, and they're really upset about it. They're offended by it. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Well, their frustration tolerance lowers, and the importance of the offense rises, and their margin is minimal. So we want to say, what is your child consistently upset over, that you hear the complaints again and again and again? It may not be name calling, may not be social exclusion. It may not even be pushes or shoves. But if someone's talking bad about me behind my back, that's verbal indirect aggression, gossip, rumors, online comments, or trolling. Their imagination goes wild and they can't stand that sort of thing. So we have to target it. And for kids who are neurodiverse, these can be very much environmental, mm-hmm. you know, noises and light and things like this. And so I have more questions for this community than I have answers for. Mm-hmm. I know the laws that govern human psychology and social dynamics, and those will never change. But I often have questions of how can we transfer this information to a child. There was a school here in Clearwater, Florida, where I live. They go through my curriculum, and it's a school that's really dedicated to the autistic population. Mm. And these children love my videos. But I asked the headmaster, I said, how do you apply my teachings? And she says, it's basically exposure response prevention therapy, because sometimes talking and explaining things logically can only go so far. That's like anyone with OCD knows that talk therapy doesn't do a dang thing for your OCD. You have to actually refuse to wash your hands for 30 minutes,
right?
You know, to rage against the tendency or compulsion to wash them. And so the same problem is with those who are neurodiverse. You have to, in incremental stages in which they can handle, expose them to the thing that once bothered them and see if you could expand their resilience margin through exposure and talk, you know, but exposure first, talk second for evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Your term resilience, that gap there, we often call it the window of tolerance, right? Because we have to, you know, help our kids open that window wider and wider, right? So like, I love that you equated emotional resilience to frustration tolerance. Frustration tolerance is something that we really struggle with often with our kids. And it is that building of that muscle, right? We need to keep exposing them incrementally in amounts that they can handle, right? Until we are building that frustration tolerance. So we're opening or widening that window of tolerance. And it can be really challenging. My own son, who's now 21, he had a really hard time in high school because he would see kids be mean to each other, not even to him. It bothered him just to see or know that it happened, that there were people around him that were hurt or upset. And so we honestly, because it was that and other things in the environment, we had to pull back on how much time he spent at school in person for a while and go to that place of tolerance, because after that, he would check out and he wouldn't be learning. He would just be frustrated, right? And and that would keep happening. And so we had to sort of step back to where his window of tolerance was and then very incrementally keep pushing just a little bit so that we could keep widening that window. And I think that's a really common practice for us in neurodiverse communities. And it helps our kids to sit with discomfort, right? Which is something I think that when we talk about poor frustration tolerance, we're talking about kids who avoid discomfort a lot of times. And it can be really tough when they're in an environment where they can't necessarily just avoid it, right? So as you're talking about, we have to build that
right.
resilience. We have to widen that margin. And it can be really challenging.
This is the downside of empathy, I think. Mm. I think empathy can be a disability sometimes or a handicap. It could certainly be a disadvantage when we feel too much. I call it secondhand victimization. That's the downside of empathy, is that I actually start to take the burden of someone else's burden. And anyone in the help therapies, you know, has to fight this. I should say the help industries. Now, this is why watching movies with a kid, like Mean Girls, you know, where people are really mean to this other girl and you're watching it. But cool thing about movies is it keeps everything in context.
Right.
And so it's something that's not bigger than you. You actually have it. It does not have you. It's not wrapped all around you 360. You're not in its environment. Mm-hmm. It is in your environment. So you could go to the TV, hold it, shake it, and everything moves. So you're actually in control. This is the same for horror movies, which are very therapeutic for kids who are scared of ghosts. Mm. Drama, you know, like social drama, like Mean Girls, fantastic to show kids of how mean people can be, and then to talk about it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, here's the crux of resilience, as far as I can tell. The thing that's hindering their resilience is their particularness. Everything must be just and so. And so we have to help them understand that this is okay. You know, it's okay that this happened. Finally, there are three things I like to ask a kid, and this helps him become more flexible. The first question I ask is, hey, how could this have been worse?
Mm.
At least that guy wasn't murdering that guy. Wouldn't that be worse? Instead, he was just yelling at him. I know it was uncomfortable to be around that type of situation, but good thing he wasn't fighting him physically, right? It could have been worse.
Mm.
Once the child realizes, yeah, you're right, it could have been worse, then you ask the second question. Why won't this matter in your future or their future? You think they're going to forget about it? Yeah, you argue with your siblings and you forget about it. They're going to argue and they'll forget about it. They'll probably be friends next week, won't they? And then the third and final question, I say, how could this turn out for their good? Or how can this turn out for your good?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they need to have this conversation. It's a tough conversation. They're dealing with the problem. That's really good. I wish they were a little calmer, but they're not. And you know what? It's actually going to turn out for their good because their friend is yelling at their other friend, you're doing this wrong, that hurt me, you need to stop. And that's going to help that person, you know, improve. And why was this good for you, son, to see? Because you're going to be in public places where people are yelling, and it's good for you to be around this sort of thing so you get used to what it's like. You're safe. You just stay out of it. Mind your own business. Don't intervene. Let them work it out. So it was good that you went through this. So reasoning, if they're capable, how could it be worse? Why won't this matter in my future? How could this turn out for my good? That helps them give up the grip of their rigidity and flexibility starts to emerge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just flexible thinking there. All three of those things are really promoting flexible thinking, which can be tough, but you know, it's a learned skill for some. It's intuitive for some, and I think it's a learned skill for some. And you know, to use my son as an example again, when he was in middle school, he was carpooling with some other boys to a charter school. And at that age, they tease each other to show camaraderie. And he couldn't pick up on that at the time. And so he thought that they were bullying him. They weren't his friends. You know, he would come in from school just irate and upset. And over time, with a lot of these conversations, just like you're talking about, he could finally look at it as something that people do. And we gave him the skills to determine what the intent was. Were they smiling or laughing when they were calling you names? You know, did they just talk to you like normal afterwards? Or did they tell you that they wished you would go away, right?
Yeah.
Like just these things. And I think, you know, he's a very concrete, literal thinker.
Yes.
And a lot of neurodivergent people are. That's where that inflexibility comes from. And so we can teach them how to bend, though, in that thinking.
I got to tell you, I listen to your podcast. I listened and followed along a little bit with your journey. And you are a good mother.
Oh,
and you are really trying to be the mother that your son needs.
Mm-hmm.
The parent is the therapist. The parent is the speech therapist. The parent is the physical therapist. The parent is the one that is perfectly positioned to train themselves to be their child's advocate.
Yeah.
And I think the dumbest thing a parent can do, ask anyone with a disability, like a blind disability or a quadriplegia disability, they will tell you with those kind of like physical disabilities, the dumbest thing parents can do is solve all their kids' problems for them.
Yep.
You know, to always take them by the arm places. Or my wife, she's quadriplegic. You know, there's some things that she says, let me try to do it on my own.
Mm.
And we've been married 23 years and she's become quite independent, but she really is quadriplegic.
Right.
All four limbs are paralyzed, you know? So, but she still needs to learn how to get around in the world, even though she's got these mm-hmm. challenges or disabilities. And so parents, your love must be tough and you're not strengthening your child by accommodating them in every single way. And that's what I'm seeing in you, Penny. You're doing such a good example, a good job of saying, I'm going to increase the load
mm-hmm.
on my son because he's going to have to learn how to deal with these things. And while it breaks my heart, I know it's best for him in the long run. And he knows you're his advocate. And I think that trust that's built helps him take on a little bit more load. So bravo.
Yeah, yeah. That was hard-won wisdom, I have to say. I was definitely a helicopter parent starting out, and I just wanted to protect them from everything, right? And I had to really step back and say, how are they going to learn? How are we going to build that window of tolerance, that resilience margin, if we swoop in and protect every time? We can't. Those two things can't exist together. And I talk all the time about it's 90% us, the parents, or the educators. It's the adult, the caring adult with the neurodivergent kid. It's 90% us understanding and changing what is going on from our perspective. We're not trying to change our kids. They are who they are. They have the wiring that they have. We're trying to help them navigate a world that wasn't built for them in a way that feels like success and joy for them. And so, you know, we know that building that frustration tolerance, that resilience is super important if you are neurodivergent trying to navigate a neurotypical world, right? And I think, you know, again, we can broaden that to the entire human experience. Resilience is what helps us navigate, right, the challenges of life.
Yes. Can I ask you a question? I think this would be the most important question of the podcast. And it's not from me. It's my question to you.
Okay.
There's a difference between an activist and an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I've never met a happy activist. They're always upset, bitching, complaining. But I have met people who are advocates that are like angels. They're absolutely inspirational. And they're always for. They're not necessarily against, but in their for, they're inversely against, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
They're for something, which means something else needs to change. So when it comes to a parent advocating for their child to the school for whatever is necessary for accommodations, for difficult kids on the bus or difficult kids in the school, what would be your advice for a parent to be an advocate without becoming an activist and making the school an enemy?
It's so hard. That's such a hard question because the dynamics feel like it's an us versus them situation. So if you walk into a room to an IEP meeting, there's one parent, sometimes the kid, depending on their age, and sometimes a second parent or, you know, another family member, and then the rest of the table is people who are there from the school's perspective, advocating for what, you know, the teachers and the school needs. And we then have to throw in these other complications like budgetary restraints on the school. So from my perspective as a parent, my kid has a legal right to a free, appropriate public education, which means it needs to be individualized for his needs. But at the same time, the school only has so many resources, right? And the law says that doesn't matter, but reality says it does matter, right? And so there's all of those kind of things that we really have to navigate as a parent that just creates that feeling, that sense often that it's one side versus another side. What I learned to do is to always come into conversations saying, this is what works for us at home, or this is something that we've seen that's been beneficial. What do you think? Do you think you could implement this in the classroom? Do you think you can make this change for this kid? And again, I'm going to come back to this. So often what we're asking for our special needs kids is good for every student. You know, I host a summit about school struggles once a year. I've done that for a few years now. And every time when we have these expert workshops, we're talking to parents and teachers. And for teachers, we have to reiterate, like, we're not asking you to do this for one kid. Do this for the whole class, because what we're talking about can be beneficial for the whole class, right? We're looking at behavior from that humanistic approach and understanding the why. And that goes for when kids are having problems with other kids socially to, you know, feeling safe in the classroom psychologically, emotionally, and socially, right? And so it's tough. It's a tough dynamic to navigate as a parent. And I think it is for educators too, because they want the best for kids. They wouldn't be an educator if they didn't, right? And so I think there's just a lot of constraints that we all have to sort of accept and work on and change as much as we can. But it can be really tough to be that advocate. Sometimes we feel like we're not heard, or we feel like we don't have enough power.
I think that is so powerful. You got to share that on your socials. You got to clip this one out, because it's very helpful. And I would just like to add one thing. The Native Americans were really masters at conflict resolution. The peace pipe comes to mind, and a small circle of restorative practice of where they would go around. And when something happened in the village, the chief would basically start and finish the meeting with the emphasis on responsibility. Here's my responsibility. This is where I failed, where I believe I need to improve, what I think that I can do. Here's my son's responsibility, what I think he needs to grow in, and what I'm going to challenge him to grow in. What could you be responsible for to help? In other words, everyone, instead of shifting blame, they take personal responsibility for improving the situation. And everyone's responsible. You know, in the Native American communities, it is truly a village. The village let you down. The village takes responsibility. And we're not going to leave here until everyone has something that they can contribute, take responsibility for improving the situation for this kid that we're all gathered here to talk about. So I would just add that as well.
I love that. Well, it's been really, really insightful to talk to you. I have looked at a lot of things from a different perspective in this conversation. One thing that really stood out to me is the idea, if we're watching a movie like Mean Girls, that we have control, because we have control over playing the movie and the screen that it's on. I never, never would have thought of that myself. And it's really empowering. And so I'm so thankful for the perspectives that you've shared here that maybe a lot of us haven't had yet, haven't thought about yet. It's going to change hearts and minds, which is what we're here trying to do, so that we can help kids. I want to encourage everyone listening to connect with Brooks and his work. You can go to brooksgibbs.com. You can also go to the show notes for this episode to find links there to his work, also any other resources that we've talked about. And those can be found at parentingadhdandautism.com/259 for episode 259. And thank you again, Brooks, for being here, for sharing with us, and also for the work that you're doing in the world, helping kids to build that resilience and have really a better life and a better journey of being themselves in the world. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Penny.
We'll see everybody next time. Take good care.
Thanks for joining me on the Beautifully Complex podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. And don't forget to check out my online courses and parent coaching at parentingadhdandautism.com and at thebehaviorrevolution.com.